The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Attack on Russian soil since World War II continued into day 9 yesterday. With the Kremlin on the back foot, President Zelensky has praised the effort and said the forces are reaching their strategic goal. Now, to tell us more about what that strategic goal might be, we're joined by Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, to most of us, Kursk is just a place on a map, but for Russians, it has incredible symbolism.
Yes, it does. If you go right back to the height of the Second World War, what the Russians still call the Great Patriotic War, you had two successive changes which really altered the whole balance of the war in Europe, one has to say. First was the relief of Stalingrad, and then in August 1943, well, 81 years ago, you had the huge tank battle of Kursk, probably the biggest land battle ever fought anywhere in the world. And that was basically a success for the Soviets and a defeat for the Germans. So Kursk is hugely symbolic, much more so in a way to the Russians than it is to the Ukrainians. And I think one has to remember that. A lot of what is happening at present does involve a degree of symbolism, although it's also an extremely serious matter, of course, as well.
So this is an important name in the history of Russia, the Battle of Kursk, and now there might be another one if the Ukrainians determine to go that far.
I think it's very unlikely that they will go very much farther. What appears to have happened was the Ukrainians really put this through as a major probe just to see how weak the Russian defences were in this part of what is, one has to remember, a 1,000-kilometre border, and they turned out to be even weaker than expected. Now, the Ukrainians were able to get more troops in very quickly, but there are indications now that their supply lines are pretty stretched, and therefore there will be something like a pause as they try to establish more secure pipeline, lines of all kinds of material. What is significant is that something like 200,000 people have been evacuated from border regions on the Russian side. Now, part of that is because if a governor of a particular district decides that an evacuation is necessary, there is sort of a central Russian aid from then on. So there's a sort of practical reason for this. But even that degree of evacuation is quite extraordinary. And it does show that in many ways, the Russian military were caught pretty severely, really out of place in many ways. And this is at a time where elsewhere, one has to remember, farther down in east and southeastern parts of the border, the Russians have been making slow, steady gains relentlessly now for several weeks. So this, in a sense, is a change for them. So far, there don't seem to be any indications that major forces have been moved from the areas of fighting down in the southeast to counter the current Ukrainian moves in over towards Kursk. And that, I think, is a surprise, because I think in some ways one of the strategic aims was to get the Russians to move some of their troops from elsewhere so that they really stopped making any further gains west into Ukraine.
So you can imagine in the Kremlin somewhere, Putin surrounded by his generals, and they're looking at the map and they're making this calculation that the Ukrainians, with their weakened supply lines, the fact that they kind of guess in this game of chess what the Ukrainians might be trying to do, and they're prepared to forfeit some of this territory temporarily and forfeit the lives of those trying to defend the territory with the longer game in mind.
Yes, and I think the emphasis was your use of the word temporarily. There are indications that the Russians have been digging in some fortifications between where the Ukrainians are now and the city of Kursk to the northeast. And so they seem to be prepared to stand up to some sort of further Ukrainian advance in the short term. But one has to remember, although it's a remarkable change that the Ukraine now actually holds Russian territory, the area concerned is pretty small compared to what the Russians already hold. It's symbolism, really, in many different ways. And this is why I think many analysts who've been surprised at the success of the Ukrainians do not expect it to be long term. And it's certainly not sufficient land to be used as a kind of bargaining chip if, hopefully, we do get down to some sort of negotiated settlement at some time.
Now, the pictures of the evacuation, you know, ordinary people carrying as much as they can onto buses and trucks to get out of the region. That evacuation, as you said, there's a logic to it that the governor of the area can therefore call on federal aid, if you like, to expedite this. But at the same time, the images are not great appearing on Russian television. And can a governor of an area act unilaterally like that without the say-so of Vladimir Putin?
I think in emergency circumstances, in all probability, yes. But you're absolutely right about the symbolism of this. It will be a shock to many Russian people that this is happening, and questions will certainly be asked. And remember, there's a very active blogosphere of former military within Russia itself, and many of them will be expressing, I would have to say, probably anger and at least dismay at what has happened. So they were getting a picture of very slow but steady Russian advances until just 6 or 7 days ago, and that has changed. Whether it's changed in the short term, whether it's psychological, or whether it goes more than that, is frankly too early to say. But it has happened, and it is certainly some indications that elsewhere in the border area, where Ukraine troops are under very heavy fire, there's some resentment that some of the elite troops have been removed from there to support this initiative over towards Kursk. So there's some tensions on both sides, but one should not diminish in any way the significance of what the Ukrainian army has done so far. And that will come as a pretty deep shock to the Kremlin, one has to say.
Now, we read that the Ukrainians have opened a hotline offering Russians who want to become refugees the opportunity of going to Ukraine, where they say, we obey all the norms of international law, you'll be safe here. I presume that is also a kind of a PR statement.
I think it's a very strong and very effective PR statement, and you may find very few people taking up the offer. One has to remember, before the war broke out, there were pretty close relations between very strongly Russian-speaking communities in eastern Ukraine and Russia itself. And there was this constant exchange across the border between people, you know, people going to visit relatives and the rest. And so you had that. But even so, I think the number of people who will head west now is going to be very small. So, yes, it is very much a propagandistic thing, and pretty clever at that, if you look at it in a detached way.
Now, the reaction in Kyiv among ordinary people, again, I read this morning that it's a mixture of satisfaction, probably grim satisfaction, but also fear. Poke the bear on what happens next.
I think that's a fair issue. And of course, we simply don't know. There is surprise, if you read some of the sharp military analysts in the West, there is surprise that Russia hasn't responded more forcefully quicker. And it seems to be really taking its time to work out what to do next. One thing one has to say about all of this is that if you want to look at who is gaining from this, on both sides, the arms manufacturers, this is an extraordinary situation, a further extension of the war, which is already incredibly good for business. And that, I'm afraid, is a reality which we rarely discuss on the media, but it is there.
That it's all about money, making money for the arms manufacturers. Where are they located? Because it would appear that back in World War II, the arms manufacturers were actually making things for both sides.
There's maybe some of that at the moment, but certainly in terms of, you know, some of the Russian armaments, and the Russian factories are working very quickly and very strongly, will use Western components, which often had to be got in by very circuitous means because of the level of the sanctions that are being realized, and have to some degree of effectiveness. But overall, the arms manufacturers, well, I mean, it's almost a glory day at present, because you have not just the terrible war in Ukraine, you have the war in Gaza. And you see the changes in the share dealings with the major companies. This is a very good area in which to own arms shares. That's a reality. And then, of course, we had the wars in Sudan, Myanmar and elsewhere. This is a good period for the arms salespeople across the board. I'm not just talking about the West, I'm talking about Russia, China and elsewhere. And that is something that we tend to forget. It is the ordinary people who suffer, but there's an awful lot of money to be made in this process as well.
Now, recently we saw the prisoner exchange where a German government kind of unlocked the whole process to allow the American journalist to be freed in Russia and an associate, shall we say, of Putin's to be returned to him, along with other swaps that went on. The Ukrainians have captured as many as 100 Russian soldiers. This also presumably is a bargaining chip.
It will be for, but this will be a more limited bargaining chip for a future prisoner exchange. And it is worth saying that, you know, with German help in the last case, but with the Red Cross and other organizations involved, there are communications, ready communications, steady communications between Russia and Ukraine and elsewhere. So it's not a completely closed system. It is, and of course, if you get this kind of exchange, sometimes conducted through Istanbul, incidentally, you do find that this is one way of reminding people that there can be talks even at this stage, and at least the war hasn't deteriorated beyond that point. And yes, absolutely, another 100 people who will be used as sort of bargaining points for a future exchange, which may be some months down the line, but will at least eventually happen, quite apart from any larger negotiations, which I think everybody would desperately want at the present time.
A comparison with World War II, when you had in Lisbon, for example, a forum where diplomats from all sides in the conflict in World War II were actually free to practice their diplomacy or their spying or whatever it might be. There doesn't seem to be any kind of common ground for Russians and Ukrainians.
No, but of course you do have all kinds of UN fora. You know, the UN Secretary General, his office and how he deals with it. The UN Assembly itself, you know, the Autumn Assembly. And you have the permanent staffs on both sides. So there are those channels. And also on particular occasions, different countries play a major role. In this and other conflicts, particularly other conflicts like Gaza, you see the Norwegian significant. As I say, Turkey has played a very significant role both in this and to some extent, a much lesser extent, in Gaza. So no, you don't have the equivalent of Lisbon, certainly, but you do have other broad similarities to that which are available and are regularly used. And there are independent groups. I mean, I'm thinking particularly, not necessarily on this occasion, the Quakers have often played a major role in very informal talks. And the aim there is you will be able to bring people from both sides together who may not be senior, but they will have the contacts, and any kind of meeting can be denied by both sides. Mm. And that's the key thing. That's when track two diplomacy really gets started.
Now, Paul, you touched on the ongoing war in Gaza, and we are told again and again, night after night, that an attack from Tehran is imminent, either through the auspices of Hezbollah in Lebanon or something more direct. And it won't happen if there is to be a fairly quickly negotiated ceasefire and hostage exchange. Do you believe any of that is likely to happen at the moment?
To be absolutely blunt, no. I don't think the Israelis are in the mood for any kind of settlement. And they believe they've got to go as far as they can, not least because of the uncertainty about the election result in November. If Trump gets in, that would be broadly useful to the Israelis. If Kamala Harris gets in, a relatively unknown quantity compared with Joe Biden, then things may be rather different. So I think it is frankly very unlikely there's going to be any short-term settlement beyond maybe a short pause of a couple of weeks to allow some degree of hostage release. But beyond that, it'd be very, very good surprise if there were further talks.
And just to try and help me understand it, at this particular time, the agreement a couple of days ago by the United States on a $20 billion arms deal for Israel, the timing seems curious.
I think it is probably a reminder to Iran that essentially the Americans are going to be backing Israel to the hilt. It's a reminder to all of us that this is already a much wider war, and the British are involved as well, although on a much smaller scale. I mean, there are attacks on American facilities in Iraq from militia who are actually very heavily influenced from Tehran, from Iran. And you're seeing American involvement in trying to intercept the Houthi drones heading for commercial shipping in the Red Sea on almost a daily basis. We think about the war expanding. In a sense, the war is already more regional than we expect. And that, I think, is one of the added dangers, because in these circumstances, you always fall back on that curious acronym AIM, accidents, incidents, and mavericks, the three issues which can take a crisis into something worse. And that, I think, is the worry of many analysts who look at these things in a broad way. It's the unexpected that you have to really try and cater for.
I shall remember that. AIM, accidents, Incidents and mavericks. Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University, thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.